The next case on the morning call is number 023844 and 023997, Raymond Zimmerman against the Chicago Board of Trade. Mr. Reed.
May it please the court. My name is Terrence Reed, and I'm here on behalf of a plaintiff class of American soybean farmers. On July 11, 1989, the Chicago Board of Trade issued an emergency order directing that all substantial holders of July 1989 soybean futures contracts liquidate them at 20% a day for the last five trading days of the contract. As a result, the cash price of soybeans and the future price of soybeans dropped. This was an extraordinary intervention in the market, and we submit that the record reflects, or certainly supports, that this intervention was not done for a legitimate regulatory purpose. Rather, this was done to enhance the financial and competitive positions of private parties.
What sort of standard that should be applied to determine what the operative motive was here? Is it, you got to show us the dominant motive or the sole motive or what? What's the standard?
I believe the standard that's been widely accepted, including by this court, is that a dominant motive has to be that the purpose was for bad faith. It was in bad faith, and that is determined by either unreasonable or for improper motive. That's the standard this court set down in the Bosco case.
Well, you have to show them the dominant motive was improper, is that right?
That's right.
And here, in the mainly self-regulatory situations, though, don't you always get into a problem of mixed motive? There's some people are going to profit and some will lose by whatever regulatory action is taken, but that doesn't preclude the regulatory body from taking the action, does it?
Well, it presupposes that there is action that's necessary to be taken, and also, which isn't the case here, but also
the issue whether it's necessary or it isn't necessary, it's whether the Board of Trade honestly thought it was necessary, isn't that the issue?
Well, yes, but if they acted because they were attempting to enhance, for example, the competitive position of Cargill, that would be an improper motive. If they act for a vendetta, for example, furthering Cargill's vendetta against Ferruzzi, that would be an improper motive. If they acted to favor the politically more powerful Shorts, that would be an improper motive. That is not only our view, but it's the testimony of the CFTC witnesses at trial. And we have record evidence here that that happened.
Well, politically more powerful just based on the notes that this man made at this meeting, isn't it?
But, Your Honor, those notes don't come out of the abstract. They are the result of a process that began in 1988 when Ferruzzi, an Italian conglomerate, bought Central Soya, a large American soybean processor. And in so doing, it acquired the ability, because Central Soya was a huge processor, to obtain what's called an anticipatory hedge. That is, it would be the CFTC said to Central Soya, because you have such huge needs for soybeans, we're not going to place the limitation that we place on traders on you of saying that you can only have 3 million bushels of soybean futures. Instead, they said Central Soya can have 120 million bushels a year. That's huge. That's because they had the huge need for soybeans. Overnight, Ferruzzi, this Italian company, had entered into the American market, and it was previously a customer of Cargill, the largest American and worldwide grain merchandiser, and went from being a customer of Ferruzzi to being a competitor of Ferruzzi in 1988. What else happened in 1988? There was a drought, so that the 1988 crop, that's the crop that's harvested in the fall of 88, was going to be small. And the market had already calculated that fact, that farmers with their field, and the price of soybeans had increased, both in absolute terms in the summer of 88, but also the futures market for the summer of 89, that's the May-June 89 futures markets, were already showing a very high price that they anticipated because of the scarcity. That was in some ways good for farmers, but who was it bad for? It was bad for any large commercial concern like Cargill, who had a need for the soybeans and was now faced with a dwindling supply of soybeans between the summer of 88 and the next harvest, which would be the new crop, which would be the fall of 89. So what did they do? Cargill in the spring starts putting on, in May that is, starts putting on large short positions in both the May contract and in the July contract, which are the two contiguous contracts. And he puts on these large short positions for Ruzzi, who's playing for, and is now a player, and is playing for the American soybean market for purpose of export to its domestic markets in Europe, says it's on the long side. They've bet the opposite side. So these two titans struggle for the soybean market using the anticipatory hedges that they have. What happens? Cargill loses. The market breaks towards Peruzzi's direction. Cargill starts experiencing huge losses. Its trading losses alone from mid-May to mid-June exceeded $20 million, according to the expert testimony. What do they do? They can't go on like this, not with a new player. So what do? They react. There's an internal memo written by a director of Cargill, a very small group, a director of Cargill by the name of James Howard. And what does he say? He says, we have Cargill, and this is the expiration of the May contract, Cargill has two objectives. First, we have to establish once and for all the parameters of the cash and futures markets as they relate to the underlying commodity. Second, our second objective is we have to punish the long. Who's the long? Peruzzi. And we have to punish the long in order to recoup our financial losses that Peruzzi made. And he even goes so far as to note that punishing the long only has value to the extent it reinforces the first objective, which is to establish once and for all the economic parameters of the cash and futures markets as they relate to commodities, in this case soybeans. That neither objective is a legitimate objective, regulatory objective. We've got testimony even from the CFTC witnesses that punishing the law is a vendetta, which has no place in the regulatory world. Obviously, taking control or trying to establish economic parameters to the market is not a legitimate regulatory purpose. What happens? This memo goes to the next level in Cargill, to Mr. Huber in particular. He initiates a what he would call a direct action plan, and he goes and he meets with the board leadership secretly and or privately in June, of June 23rd, both the chairman and the president of the Board of Trade, talks to them, presses their complaint about soybeans. He has invited Cargill's member on the Board of Trade, of Cargill's director. He's a senior management official at Cargill, who happens to be on the board of directors of the CBOT, into the meeting. So that's the backdrop of those notes from Mr. Weisenborn. This is his personal echoing of what has been happening. How does he describe it? He says, there's pressure on the BCC to get the other guy. The shorts expect to be rescued. Who are the shorts? Cargill. He says that the members have responded, but non-members have not, characterizing the dispute as one between Peruzzi and Cargill. He says, we have an emergency weapon. It's the nuclear bomb. What happens if you drop the nuclear bomb? The winners go to the bank. The losers go to the newspapers. So those notes aren't in the abstract. They are echoes of Cargill's direct action plan as articulated and implemented, not only with memorandum, but with meetings meetings with other directors, including meetings with Mr. Hollander, another director who was turned out to be the mover of the emergency.
These problems are intrinsic in the self-regulatory scheme of things. I mean, assuming that the Board of Trade, and there's plenty of evidence they had regulatory reasons for doing this, assuming that it was going to help Cargill and hurt Peruzzi, so what?
You put your finger on something very important.
I mean, self-regulation has this problem inherently built into it, doesn't it?
Self-regulation doesn't say that the regulators are serving the interests of private parties.
But the private parties come in and lobby them to do various things.
Sure, but the point here is, this isn't lobbying. This is coming in and saying, we want you to punish the law. We want you to come in here and get the other guy. We want you to come in here and do the things that we cannot do directly. In fact, there was testimony from Mr. Howard at trial saying that they had to use the CBOT because they couldn't do it directly. So, but you put your finger on something very important, Your Honor, and that is, why did this evidence go to the jury? Because the judge below basically embarked on his own set of fact finding. For example, he determined that there was a corner, okay, that Peruzzi had cornered the market in June of 1989. The problem with that is that is legally, factually, I mean, economically, and mathematically impossible. Why? Because the CFTC had already intervened in a private manner, sent a letter to Peruzzi on July 11th saying, you have to be out of your hedge. You have to reduce your position in the July futures contract to 3 million bushels.
But didn't the CFTC give the Board of Trade 5 options that they could proceed on?
This is
one of them?
There is a factual dispute as to whether that was done. Oh. But there is evidence, irrefutable evidence in the record. When I asked the CFTC regulator, Mr. Mokey, did the CFTC direct the CBOT to take emergency action? He said no. And that's consistent with what the CFTC told this court in 1992 in the original case before this court, where the CFTC told this court in an amicus, which this court then relied upon in determining that there wasn't antitrust immunity, that the CFTC did not tell the board what to do here. This was independent action of the board, never reviewed by the CFTC. But going back to the point of a corner, the CFTC had already done its due diligence, and it knew and shared this information with the board that in Chicago warehouses, there was only 5 million bushels of soybeans that was in the hands, outside of Peruzzi's hands. Why is that important? Because to have a corner, you have to have control of the deliverable supply of the commodity. You got to have essentially all or most of the commodity. Here, in Chicago warehouses, was more than enough soybeans to satisfy the maximum demand that Peruzzi could make, 3 million. And our experts said not only that, but in the 350-mile radius of Chicago, there's 180 million bushels of soybeans, meaning that's the trucking distance for soybeans into Chicago during the last 10 days of a delivery month. They established the 10-day delivery period in the 1930s to make sure that shorts would always have an extra period of time in which to go to the countryside, to farmers, to get the soybeans and deliver. And using that existing mechanism, he said there was 180 million bushels of soybeans that shorts had access to deliver. Obviously, if all Peruzzi can demand is 3 million bushels from the market, from the futures market, then money was up there. There was 180 million in the suburbs, if you will, that could be used to satisfy that. There was no mathematical way that there could have been a corner. However, the district court judge relied on that. He said, well, I believe there must have been a corner, which we think is a jury function, and the expert evidence is just the contrary. But nonetheless, he says, not only I think it was a corner, that gives me the right to determine that they acted in good faith and determine the motivations of the defendant. And if you take that pillar out, that there was a corner, and it's established and known that there really wasn't a corner, it couldn't possibly be a corner, then you can't then say, well, they must have acted reasonably because there was a corner, which is what the judge said. So we respectfully submit that the evidence of record here is more than enough to require that this issue affecting American soybean farmers be submitted to a jury. And the standards are clear. We believe that the evidence of the Cargill Action Plan and its clearly identified objectives and its implementation all the way through to the emergency order is sufficient to require a jury to determine the bona fides of the individual defendant, specifically whether they acted in good faith or, more precisely, acted in accordance with their written word at the time and therefore in bad faith, as established by the testimony of the CFTC witnesses saying, you do that, you're in bad faith. If you do that, that's an improper, it's not a proper regulatory reason to intervene in the market, to have changed the market to the detriment, in this case, of the American farmer. I see my time has expired. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Reed. We'll hear now from Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Your Honor. I should say, three of us have been with this case from the beginning. Your Honor, in 92, when I argued the case the first time, and Judge Cudahy in, I guess, 94 or 95. In those decisions, this court did not relieve the plaintiffs of their obligations to prove the elements of their case. And in fact, in 1992, this court took pains to emphasize that while it was deciding that the Board of Trade's action was not immune under the antitrust laws, that on remand, the plaintiffs would be obligated to prove their case. And they would have to prove it both under the rule of reason that applies to Section 1 antitrust cases generally, but they would also have to prove it under the additional bad faith standard that applies to emergency actions taken by boards of trade, contract markets under the Commodity Exchange Act. Much of Mr. Reed's argument is an argument he wanted to make to the jury, but it's not backed up by evidence in the case. For example, he argued that it would be wrong to take this action to benefit Cargill. What he ignores there is that the trial proof was that there would be no benefit to Cargill of this emergency action. And in fact, the expert who gave an opinion said that while he didn't look at all of Cargill's positions, he did say that in order to know what the impact on Cargill would be, one would need to know what Cargill's positions were, both in the futures market and in the cash market. He then, from his documentation that he had gathered, we went through a large trader report that he got from the CFTC, and his analysis was that in July, if in fact there had been a 25-cent diminution in value of cash soybeans, that Cargill would have lost $15 million. So the idea that this factual record supports the proposition that this was done to benefit Cargill is contrary, directly contrary, to the evidence in the case.
Wouldn't Cargill have lost a lot more than that if their competitor had a corner?
Actually, no, because Cargill was out of the July market. They were completely out by mid to late June, and had a very small position that they put back in late June, a short position. And by the way, Mr. Reed also described Cargill's position in May as a hedge position. That would be true, of course, only if Cargill had physical soybeans to match it. If Cargill in fact had needs to purchase more soybeans, their hedge position would have been to go long, and they would have been on the same side of the market.
They were just speculating then, I guess.
No, I think they were hedge positions, but I think they were hedge positions against contracts they had. But the record is, the record's silent on that. We didn't get to that point.
This might be a good time, Mr. Johnson, for you to take a moment to answer your adversary on whether there really was a corner on the market by the Italian firm.
That would be fine. Let me also answer his accusation that Judge Anderson found that there was a corner. We don't know if there was a corner, and it's not necessary, it's frankly not terribly important to our case to know if there was a corner. I think what Judge Anderson, in fairly reading what he said, was in shorthand talking about was what's undisputed, and that is that Ferruzzi controlled an overwhelming position both on the long side of the open interest of the contract and in the warehouse receipts. I believe their position on July 11 was in excess of 60% of the open interest and in excess of 85% of the warehouse receipts. To find an actual corner, of course, you need to have a finding on artificial price. You need to have a finding on Ferruzzi's intent. None of that was tried in this case. And while plaintiff's theory was, plaintiff's expert said, well, if there was no corner, then there was no reason for the Board of Trade to act. At least that was their theory. What he acknowledged was that the definition of market emergency is way broader than simply acting in the face of a proved corner. It includes an attempted corner. It also includes a threat to orderly liquidation. And everybody admitted, including the plaintiff's expert, and he's the only one they put forward as evidence of their point on this, he admitted that on July 11th, it was reasonable for the CFTC, and we say if it was reasonable for the CFTC, then it was also reasonable for the Board of Trade, to believe that there was a threat to orderly liquidation of the July contract. That's what the CFTC determined, and that is what Professor Williams said was a reasonable determination. Let me address another point that Mr. Reed made.
A corner exists if the shorts, there just aren't enough soybeans around for the shorts to be able to cover. Is that, that may be too simplistic, but isn't it?
Yeah.
Essentially what we're talking about.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and there are specific rules about what is a corner, what's not a corner, but it's absolutely clear that the Board of Trade has to guard not just against corners, but against threatened corners and against threat to orderly liquidation. In other words, they have to guard against distortions in their market, in the futures market, that could take place and can take place even in the absence of an actual corner. I also wanted to address Mr. Reed's claim that there is a factual dispute about whether on the morning of the 11th of July the CFTC sent 5 suggested actions to the Board of Trade, because there is no such factual dispute. Every witness that testified that the CFTC sent those recommendations to the Board of Trade, and that includes not only Chairman Malman of the Board of Trade, but also Mr. Milkey of the CFTC in Washington and Mr. Cass of the CFTC here in Chicago. What the uniform testimony was that on the afternoon of the 10th of July, Mr. Malman called Wendy Graham, the chairman of the CFTC, told her what had been recommended by the Business Conduct Committee, and asked for suggestions about what the Board of Trade might do. The following morning, they had another call, and she indicated that they were going to fax to the Board of Trade some suggestions. And that's exactly what DX-12 is. It is that fax. It is those suggestions plus an attachment of the CFTC's letter to Ferruzzi of the same day. So there's no dispute about what that is. What there is a claim on the part of the plaintiffs a claim based entirely on a witness, Professor Williams, who says he has no regulatory expertise and in fact was not put forward as a regulatory expert. A claim that in fact the Board of Trade could not revoke hedge exemptions and therefore this must be something else. That's their argument. In fact, and this was also in the record, in May of 1989, the Board of Trade had put in an emergency rule that allowed them, in parallel with the CFTC, to grant hedge exemptions and then to revoke them. That was in the report of the Trading and Markets describing this situation of September 7, 1989. An exhibit that was offered and not, at least not yet, admitted into evidence below, but it's part of the record. It was also alluded to in the, I believe it was August 24th letter from Wendy Graham to Congress that was part of the record before this court in 1992 when the debate was whether there was antitrust immunity here. So it is absolutely clear from the record that that list of five recommendations was sent to the Board of Trade on that morning. I'd like to, I started out by pointing out that this court didn't relieve the plaintiffs of their obligation to prove an antitrust case. It did not. It emphasized they had to prove both bad faith and a violation of the rule of reason. They didn't even attempt to demonstrate a violation of the rule of reason. They made no attempt to define a relevant market. They made no attempt to put in proof of market power. And when I'm talking about market power, I'm talking about market power that the Board of Trade might have had in the markets for cash soybeans. They did not put on any proof of impact in those markets. They did not put on any proof that any restraint in those markets was unreasonable. And they put on no proof, really, of the bad faith needed to make out a claim. Oddly enough, they didn't even put in proof necessary to make out the most basic element of a Section 1 case, and that is an agreement or conspiracy in restraint of trade. The case that was before this court twice before was a case that alleged that there was a conspiracy among Board of Trade board members because of their affiliation with grain merchants who needed to buy soybeans to take action in the futures market that would manipulate the price in the cash market. By the time we got to trial, all that had fallen away. There was no trial proof, no effort to make a trial proof that anyone who was involved in the deliberations at the Board of Trade needed to buy cash soybeans in July of 1989. That includes Cargill. There was no proof, no attempt to put evidence on that Cargill needed to buy cash soybeans in July of 1989. They had years to take discovery, and they had a trial, and they didn't even try to make that proof. Instead, what they went to trial on was a different kind of case, one in which they claimed that there was a conspiracy in the futures market that had an ancillary impact on farmers in the cash market. To infer a conspiracy, though, their proof, their attempted proof was limited to a conspiracy with Cargill. And I would urge this court to look at the evidence very carefully that Mr. Reed cited to. The one-page internal Cargill document that he refers to is at 872 of the joint appendix. That's a document that's undisputed, never went to the Board of Trade, was never shared with the Board of Trade, but was an internal Cargill document. it cannot fairly be read as a price manipulation document. Worse yet,
well, Cargill is not a defendant here. You mentioned at the outset proof of the relevant market and the market power and so on. Under the theory that's being pursued here, wouldn't those requirements apply to Cargill rather than to the Board of Trade?
I think they have. I don't see why they would escape the requirements of an antitrust case because they sued the wrong people. I agree with you should have been tried against Cargill, but they didn't name
it. Board of Trade doesn't have, presumably doesn't have market power, I guess. But Cargill might well have it. That's what
I suppose that if we're talking about a futures trader coming in and suing the Board of Trade under Section 1, it might be able to say that the Board of Trade had done something like one of the recommendations that the CFTC proposed, and that is close out all the contracts at a price. That would have been an exercise of market power in the futures market. In any case, the evidence here, and I would urge you to do it, there's a 5-page memo that talks about an action plan. That evidences a very strongly held concern by Cargill that the Board of Trade's markets were not properly functioning, were not performing as price discovery vehicles or as hedging vehicles. That's the only fair reading of that document. In 5 pages, there's nothing in there that says our action plan is to go manipulate the price of the July future so that we can make money in the cash markets. That's completely unfair of a reading. And that's at the Joint Appendix 874 to 78. The 2-page letter that reflects the meeting that Mr. Reed talked about is at 879 and 80. That can't fairly be read as a conspiratorial document either. Plaintiffs made no effort to make out the other elements of their antitrust case either. They have to prove a substantially adverse effect on competition. Instead, their own expert admitted that in the cash markets, supply and demand drive price. He admitted that there was no impact on supply and demand. Actually, what he admitted was there was no impact on supply of soybeans, cash soybeans, as a result of this. And if there had been any impact on demand, it would have been to increase demand in the cash market because Ferruzzi, by reason of this order, was pushed into the cash market to buy soybeans if, in fact, it needed soybeans. So they made no effort to make that proof. They made no effort to establish, as this court said they must in 1995, the necessary lockstep between cash prices and futures prices. Judge Cudahy, your opinion in the Loeb case, concurring in that case, emphasized both that the Sanner case was a motion to dismiss case, and I've talked about the fact they failed to prove it on the trial, but also the need for a lockstep to establish standing. And that while in 1995 it was appropriate to assume these plaintiffs could prove lockstep, in fact, as the trial progressed in 2002, lockstep was disproved. There was no sale of soybeans after this emergency order anywhere in any market that was made basis the July future.
But I guess that Judge Wood's opinion in Sumitomo prescribes the requirements for lockstep at this point.
I'm not suggesting that the court's opinion should be disregarded in favor of Your Honor's opinion. I'm simply focusing on the fact that both Judge Wood and Your Honor emphasized the importance of the fact that the Sanner case had been a motion to dismiss case and the importance of lockstep, and that not only did these plaintiffs fail to prove lockstep, they disproved lockstep. That is, what was proved was that every possible sale by a farmer in July after this order was a sale that either had no reference to any Board of Trade price, and their expert made no effort to find out which ones did and which ones didn't, or had reference to some Board of Trade price other than the July.
Of course, in Sumitomo, he had a price formula for going futures to cash. I mean, he applied a premium to the futures price and came out with a cash price.
Right, and those were rigid formulas that was entirely different from this. In this one, local grain elevators quote whatever price they want, and some of them referenced a Board of Trade price. But there was always an additional basis, and that was always negotiable. It varied from market to market and varied up and down. So they disproved the lockstep that was necessary to this court's standing ruling. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. You have 5 minutes, and Mr. Reed.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I'd like to respond by saying that this is a conspiracy case, and there certainly are enough facts here that need to be examined and construed, but conspiracy cases are, by definition, a wealth not only of facts, but of circumstantial evidence. Here, we have both circumstantial evidence, which I'll describe, and also we've got direct evidence of intent to manipulate the market. Let's talk briefly about Cargill. The jury's not going to have to speculate as to Cargill's motivations. It wrote them down, what its motivations were. Not only in terms of the documents that counsel asked you to revisit, and we urge you to do so as well, but also in their internal correspondence. They said it was high noon for us. They said that the future of the future profitability of Cargill is at stake. So Cargill's motivation is clear. It's there. It's also supported by the expert testimony, the only expert of record here, who said their incentive was to decrease the price of soybeans so that they could have a cheaper cost, processing costs, and cost to replace their existing inventories. Essentially, the defense offered no answer to this court's question about the corner. I mean, there is $3 million in all foods he could possibly obtain using its futures contract, and there was more than that there. They knew that. The CFTC knew that. The CFTC made sure of that. There was absolutely no emergency, and they knew it. But that would not satisfy. The CFTC's private action was secret. It wasn't known to the world. It wouldn't affect the market. So that's why they had to issue a public, notwithstanding the prior action by the CFTC, they had to issue a public liquidation order to have that depressing effect. Was there a depressing effect? I don't know. I'm quite baffled, quite frankly, at counsel's comments. He didn't attend the same trial I did. We had expert testimony on all these points from a preeminent expert who testified as to market power. He testified as to the impact on the market. He testified about the restraint being unreasonable. He testified about a substantially adverse effect on the market, specifically a price effect. The law of this circuit and others and the Supreme Court is that you don't even need market power where you have an adverse price effect. Here, we had opinion testimony on market power, but on top of that, we had the proof expert and expert testimony subjected to Daubert analysis for methodology that there was a price effect. Their own defense expert testified at the Daubert hearing that, yes, indeed, the emergency order depressed the prices of cash soybeans using his methodology. I don't know why we're here raising that as an issue on this record. On the lockstep issue, with all due respect, that's a red herring. Our expert testified that he used his language, which he's written of in his three books published by Cambridge University Press on the futures market. He calls it a web. He prefers his parlance, that there's a web between cash and futures prices. But he said that not only in general does one affect the other, but he said in this instance, using his methodologies, he determined not only what the price effect, which the defense expert agreed on, but he quantified it. He was able to quantify what the price effect was caused by specifically by the emergency order. So this isn't a question of lockstep. This isn't a question of market power. This is a question of the uncontradicted full expert evidence, in this case showing that the emergency order depressed the price, causing specific and quantifiable harm to the American farmer. Uh, I could also address with one other issue. The question about the faxing of a letter from the CFTC, that was a fax from Mr. Milkey, where he put in a list of alternatives. Those alternatives, three of the alternatives weren't even available for the CBOT. Why? Because while the CFTC had hedge exemptions, the anticipatory hedge exemptions I talked about, that was an ongoing existing program, and they had a specific exemption for Ferrucci, they didn't. The CBOT didn't. They were even hadn't even started their program. So there was nothing that the CBOT could do about legally about Ferrucci's position. That was solely subject to the jurisdiction and the regulatory authority of the CFTC. It acted effectively, and its witness at trial, their witness, came forward, Mr. Milkey, and said, "We didn't tell them to issue an emergency order." That, at a minimum, creates a factual issue for the jury, but we submit it's conclusive. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Reed. Our thanks to both counsel for both your fine briefs and certainly for the illuminating oral argument today. The case will be taken under advisement.